This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. An election rouse erupted over Labor leader Anthony Albanese's backing of a big pay rise for the lowest paid workers. The current national minimum wage is $20.33 per hour, and the opposition leader agrees it should increase by at least 5.1%, which is the current rate of inflation. The independent umpire, the Fair Work Commission, will decide what it will be, but the government's arguing Mr. Albanese's comments are unprecedented interference. So what do workers think about potential pay rises? Our reporter David Sparks has been finding out.
In the southwest Sydney suburb of Punchbowl, there are plenty of people on low incomes. Many work in hospitality, like this man who says he makes just over $20 an hour.
No, at the moment, prices, day by day, prices increase, but salary is not getting up. So very hard to live and survive.
What's your job? What do you do?
I do a restaurant job.
What, waiting, cooking?
No, cooking.
Can you tell me how much you earn per hour?
$20 something, $22 something.
It's not much, is it?
Not much, is it?
Another man, Nas, is sitting with his son in front of a cafe. He's a carpenter and says it feels like his wage is going backwards.
It's still the same and down and lower, even lower. They're not paying the right rates because we work for the subbies. It doesn't pay the good rates for us.
And he says he's not the only one feeling the pinch of wages, struggling to keep up with rises in the cost of living.
All the people struggling in the wages here. It's not good, it's not enough. Everything, all the price has gone up.
Do you think anyone can do anything about it?
I think we wish the Labour Party come, like, take the government this year. So I think we'll be better. We'll be better for the wages and the rates. I think the wages is going to go up.
This 16-year-old boy in high viz is walking home after a day of work.
I'm a carpenter. I do carpentry.
First year apprentice?
First year apprentice.
Do you mind if I ask how much you get now?
14 and a half an hour.
How much do you get next year?
Next year I'll be getting probably 16 an hour.
Do you think it should be higher than that, or do you think it's appropriate?
I think it should be higher. I'll be driving next year, petrol, everything, so yeah.
Labor says they're the ones that'll best chance of a wage increase. Liberal says they're the best increase. Do you believe in him?
I don't believe none of them, no.
Why not?
Because everyone says that every single 4 years, everyone says that and nothing happens.
But for this operator of a small independent supermarket on the main road in Punchbowl, having to give out a pay rise will be extremely difficult.
Very difficult because just the price of everything has just skyrocketed, sales are down, people are just, you know, doing it hard at the moment. So we've had things go up 300%, 200%. It's ridiculous. So the money's just not there to pay, you know, yeah, what I mean? The revenue's not there like it was a couple of years ago.
Can you understand why people all across the economy want a wage increase with inflation the way it is?
100%. I think they deserve a pay increase. I think they need a pay increase, but we need to generate the revenue to give them the pay increase.
Could anything be done? Politicians on both sides with this election are talking about boosting wages. Do you think anyone can do anything?
Well, I'm not, you know, an economic expert, but I'm sure there's ways of stimulating the economy. They've done it in the past, but these are unprecedented times at the moment, so it's hard to answer that question without, you know, the knowledge.
A Sydney business operator ending that report by David Sparks. So what can be done to get wages rising faster? A new report suggesting that governments will have to intervene. For more, I spoke with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, does this report provide any hope that wages will rise enough to manage inflation and rising interest rates?
Well, good morning, Sabra. This wages study from the Adelaide Law School, the Melbourne Law School and the Centre for Future Work sees wages stuck at historically weak levels. That's despite the 4% jobless rate. That would normally mean tough competition for workers and, as a result, higher wages. Now, this report says 4% wages growth is likely in the coming years if we get productivity higher. But until then, it suggests targeted policies to pretty much manufacture higher wages, including a new definition of employment to stop businesses from presenting workers as being self-employed, dealing with wages theft, gender pay inequity, and strengthening the regulation of the minimum wage. The ACTU wants a 5.5% increase, while the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry will today support a 3% increase as reasonable. The report's co-author, Dr. Jim Stanford, says without government intervention, wages will continue to stagnate. It's going to be tough to turn around the mantra from some parts of business and government that suppressing wages in the past has been good policy.
I'm not optimistic at all that wages will pull out of this sustained decade-long slump unless we implement active wage-boosting measures. Governments have worked to keep wages down. We've been warned for years that wages were too high, that we had to suppress wages in order to boost business confidence and boost business profits. In a way, it's become a so-called design feature of our economy to try and keep wage growth low. And lo and behold, it's worked. So if we want wages to grow faster, we have to rebuild the things that helped wages grow in the past. That includes higher minimum wages, that includes stronger collective bargaining, and it includes governments taking their foot off of wage gains in the public sector by leaving behind those pay caps that they've had in place for many years.
And that's Dr. Jim Stanford from the Centre for Future Work. Peter, wages as well as productivity and external costs can all affect inflation. So how likely is a 5% wage rise, which Mr. Albanese's endorsed, to match the cost of living?
Well, Sabra, that's going to be very tough because something as big as a 5% rise in wages would only contribute to inflation, and the Reserve Bank would need to raise interest rates even faster to get inflation under control back into that 2 to 3% target band. And of course, that would put more pressure on the cost of living and higher mortgage repayments.
Peter Ryan there. China's foreign minister is likely to visit Honiara later this month as Beijing moves quickly to cement its security and economic ties with Solomon Islands. The visit's likely to catapult the security agreement between the two countries back into the headlines, potentially just days before the federal election. Our foreign affairs reporter is Stephen Jedgetts. Stephen, good morning. Do we know for sure that this trip is going ahead, and could it deliver a few more surprises?
No, Sabra, we don't know for certain that this trip will happen. It certainly sounds pretty likely. One Solomon Islands government source told the ABC that planning for the visit had now begun in both Honiara and in Beijing. And Australian government sources also think it will happen, although they're a little bit less definitive. They seem to think the trip will probably be part of a broader regional visit to the Pacific by Wang Yi, but some of this may still well be in flux. And yes, of course, then the next question is, Sabra, what will Wang Yi do or promise if he does go to Honiara? Now, most observers seem to think that he's likely to lead a pretty substantial delegation, and he certainly won't come empty-handed. It's likely that there'll be several other agreements, MOUs or commercial deals signed by both countries if he does make the trip. Perhaps China might offer new investments in infrastructure, in tuna processing, or in mining, just for example. And of course, it's also possible that the minister will take the opportunity to formally sign the deeply contentious security pact that has already been agreed to by both Solomon Islands and China. Now, given both countries have said the agreement is already done and dusted, this would likely be more symbolic than anything else, but it's pretty potent symbolism.
And what implications might this actually have for the federal election campaign?
Well, the timing of this trip, that's if it does go ahead, is probably the most interesting question here in one sense. Now, the ABC has been told that the visit's expected to happen this month. Now, that could well mean that it may happen before, and potentially just before, the federal election on next weekend. And of course, again, it's the symbolism here that matters. The images of Wang Yi being garlanded in Honiara and formally signing the security pact just ahead of the election could be pretty potent. And the coalition, perhaps unsurprisingly, worries that the visit will once again catapult the China-Solomon Islands security deal back into the headlines, allowing Labor to once again attack its national security credentials just before the federal election. Now, last night, the Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, was on Sky News. He was asked about the possible visit to Honiara by Wang Yi, and he suggested that the timing of the trip might even be deliberate. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
It's obviously provocative, particularly during the course of an election campaign, that China has made that decision. And I think we, again, need to be eyes wide open about what is happening in our region.
The Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, and before him, our reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. In almost every part of the country, finding a place to rent any place is really difficult. And for many families, getting an affordable rental is almost impossible. In the Queensland city of Bundaberg, the shortage is so bad that even people with stable jobs are living in cars or tents, as John Daly reports.
And what's your favourite dinosaur, do you reckon?
On his bedroom floor, 4-year-old Caden is showing off his dinosaur collection.
Is that off Jurassic Park?
Yeah.
Ah.
But he'll soon have to pack up his toys. His family's rental home is being sold, and his mum, Taylor Dipple, hasn't found anywhere else to live.
We just can't find one. There's just not enough places and too many people. My partner's got a full-time job. He's making decent money and we can afford it, but there's, yeah, just not enough places.
Where are you going to go?
In a tent, unfortunately, and all the caravan parks are booked out, so it's looking like either we go out camping in the bush, and usually that's only a week stay, or in the 24-hour rest stops.
She says each rental has hundreds of applicants, and with a 7-month-old and another baby on the way, she's worried.
It's winter, it's freezing, it's raining all the time at the moment. They're tiny, you know, and you don't want them being out in the cold. You know, you don't want to see your kids in a tent. And, yeah, by the looks of it, I'll be having the newborn in the tent with us as well.
At the Angels Community Group Support Centre in Bundaberg, I meet Christy, who's got a job but is still sleeping in a tent.
Absolute joke. You try and go for a rental and there's 300 applications. Working, like I said, working full-time, so money's not a problem, but I'm still resorted to living in a tent at a friggin' scout hall.
Yeah.
The rental vacancy in Bundaberg is 0.4%, the lowest in a decade. The city sits in the safe LNP-held electorate of Hinkler, which also includes Childers and Hervey Bay.
And what else is your basic stuff in there?
Angels Community Group CEO Sue Tasker says homelessness and housing are big problems throughout the region.
It's terrible. We see it every day. And it's working people. It's not just your typical, what you imagine is a homeless person. They're either couch surfing or they're actually living on the streets. They're living in their cars. Yeah, it's quite scary how bad it is for people. I remember when I first started doing support work and that, the homeless was very, very few in Bundaberg, but not to the extent we have now. It's definitely got dramatically worse.
And she's worried about whether anything can be done to solve the problem.
Kids shouldn't be sleeping in their cars and then going to school the next day. And it's not just Bundaberg, it's across the board. So I think we need some quick answers. The solution isn't probably a quick one, but I think we need something to be done now so that people have somewhere safe to sleep.
Angels Community Group CEO Sue Tasker ending John Daly's report there. Australia's health systems have been under huge strain during the COVID pandemic. At times, there've been a shortage of workers, and while recruiting overseas health workers might seem like an easy solution, some in the sector say unnecessary red tape is keeping many talented workers from coming here. Medical reporter Sophie Scott has the story.
That's a script for Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
The owners of this busy medical practice on Victoria's Mornington Peninsula have been desperately trying to recruit new doctors for more than 2 years. Co-owner Simon Spalding spent more than $25,000 securing a GP from the UK.
In all, it took over a year, and some of the delays caused great distress to our doctor. It is a very difficult and big step for people to come out here, and I just think my main message would be we need to make it as easy as possible to get these wonderful clinicians out here.
And it's not only GPs who are in short supply. Tom Simonson is the CEO of the Victorian Healthcare Association.
In Victoria alone, we have thousands of vacancies just for nurses before you even start to think about doctors and allied health professionals and midwives.
He says the pandemic has shown up serious shortcomings in Australia's health workforce strategy.
We always needed international recruitment as part of a balanced strategy, but with it not having been an option for most of the last 2 years, that's really made it so much worse.
American nurse Joshua Gregory has been trying for 4 years to come and work in Australia.
So as a registered nurse, I've worked in cardiothoracic care. I've worked in emergency medicine. I've worked ICU. I've worked psychiatrics. And I feel that I have a level of flexibility that would really benefit Australia.
He says the process was time consuming because regulatory bodies didn't communicate effectively with each other. He's had to register twice as a nurse, then apply for a visa.
For me personally, I began this process when I was 32 years old. I'm now 36 years old.
He's grateful that he's now had an offer for a sponsored visa from the South Australian government.
This entire time, I've actually used a little colloquialism from Australia that she'll be right and that I'm going to get there eventually.
To work in Australia as a health practitioner, you need to apply to be registered with a board through ARPRA, the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, then apply for a visa through the Immigration Department. Tom Simonson wants a national review of the health workforce strategy.
When you look at other countries like the UK, they've put in place a specialised healthcare worker visa where processing times are 3 weeks.
A spokesman for ARPRA says the assessment process involves a number of important checks and any improvements must not sacrifice this, and that they work closely with other departments to streamline application processes.
I'm hopeful.
As for Joshua Gregory, he hopes he'll get the final go-ahead to start work in South Australia soon.
Sophie Scott reporting. After 5 relatively quiet years, North Korea's launched a flurry of missiles in recent weeks and even appears to be preparing a nuclear test. Pyongyang's posturing is seen as retaliation for the hawkish language from South Korea's new president, who was sworn in yesterday. North Asia correspondent James Oten reports.
A new era for South Korea. Tens of thousands of people gathered in the nation's capital to see the new president sworn in. Yoon Suk-yeol's a fresh face to politics. His time as a public prosecutor helped him win a narrow victory against a scandal-plagued government.
As a politician, he has not been tested at all. But the lack of experience in politics as usual turns out to be his best asset.
Dr. Yong-shik Bong is a politics expert at Yonsei University.
South Korean public very strongly want to have a new type of politics.
One key area of change will be handling North Korea and its nuclear weapons ambitions. Former President Moon Jae-in walked a path of delicate diplomacy, whereas Yoon Suk-yeol is expected to take a harder approach and demand results before concessions. At his inauguration, he made an offer.
If North Korea genuinely embarks on a path to complete denuclearization, we're prepared to work with the international community to develop an audacious plan to vastly strengthen their economy.
Jongmin Kim is lead correspondent for the online publication NK News.
Yoon was not shy to talk about things such as preemptive strike against North Korean command forces.
That's agitated Pyongyang. In recent weeks, it's launched a string of missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic missile that could, in theory, reach the U.S. mainland.
A bit of a change in rhetoric from North Korea, because they are hinting at the potential use of tactical nuclear weapons against South Korea and not just the United States.
The United States is now warning North Korea could soon conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. It'll push for heavier sanctions against the regime at the UN Security Council, but that won't likely succeed.
It seems that Russia and China and North Korea they're treading closer than before. From China's perspective, it will be, first of all, difficult to restrain North Korea like they did before. And second of all, they would not have much interest as before restraining North Korea because it's one of the leverages that China also has.
Yoon Suk-yeol has made it clear his allegiances lie with the United States.
He argues that the days of the strategic ambiguity of South Korea between China and the United States are in the past.
He's even expressed some interest in joining the Quad with the US, Australia, India and Japan, but he's denied making any formal requests. This is James Oten reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.